Sentire Media.
Ciao a tutti and welcome to Venice Talks, a podcast series dedicated to Venice in Italy. I'm your host, Monica Cesarato, a Venetian food and travel blogger. Join me as I share my insider knowledge to help you explore Venice at 360 degrees. In this weekly podcast, we'll dive into the heart of the city, uncovering hidden stories and connecting with the people who make Venice unique. The artisans, the writers, the fashion designers, the bloggers, the journalists, and more. Let's break free from cliché and discover the true essence of Venice, not just the monuments, but the vibrant people, the Venetians. Experience Venice the right sustainable way. You can find me on my blog at www.monicacesarato.com and across all social media platforms. Enjoy the episode and let's journey through Venice together. Welcome back to Venice Talks, Season 2, Episode 2. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Venice Talks. Today, my special guest is Giulio Bobo, member of the IVESA Board of Directors, Vice President of the Provincial AMPI of Venice, a scholar of studying fascism and the resistance movement, and an author of many, many books dedicated to the topic. Hi, Giulio, how are you?
Hello, Monica. Doing well, thank you. Happy to be with you.
Thank you so much. So, first of all, let's explain to everybody what IVESA is, even though I like the English version. IVESA sounds so better. Sounds so good.
Okay. IVESA is the acronym for Istituto Veneziano per la Storia della Resistenza. And that means that it is a provincial institute who is dedicated to the study of the history of resistance, fascism resistance, but more widely the contemporary period, so mostly the 20th century, in our province of Italy. It is belonging to a net of similar institutes who are practically in every province in the north and in the center part of Italy and some provinces of the south. And they are all belonging, and they are all communicating with a national institute in Milan, who is dedicated to the memory of Ferruccio Parri, one of the political leaders of the resistance during the Second World War, who decided in the late 40s to found this institute, where the focus was to study the resistance from a scientific point of view.
So it is sorry if I interrupt you. Very interesting, because it happened just after the war ended then. They had this awareness straight away.
You know, yes, because that is part of a bigger context. The problem, what it was, Ferruccio Parri was intellectual. Himself was belonging to the Partito d'Azione, Action Party, who was a particular political party who existed in Italy during the clandestinity, during the fascism, and during the resistance, and briefly after the Second World War. It was, talking from an international point of view, it was a bit of a social democrat and a bit of a republican party. And it was many of the cream of the intellectuals and the society, Italian society at the time, were belonging to this party. I will just make also an example. The Rosselli brothers, who were killed by the fascists, exactly because they were so dangerous, even before the war. And Norberto Bobbio, who is one of the most important political philosophers of the time, were belonging to this party. So he understood that with the war, with the Cold War happening after the Second World War, the resistance was becoming a very political subject, because part of the forces who fought in the resistance, like the Liberal Party or the Christian Party, that in Italian was called Democrazia Cristiana, more or less forgot, or we're not talking about that.
And well, of course, it was convenient for them to forget about it, wasn't it?
Well, they were. It was not to remember the resistance was not a priority in their agenda.
Exactly.
While the Communist Party and the Socialist Party were still making it important, rightfully, because the Constitution and the Italian Republic, it came after the Second World War. It is part of the resistance.
Of course.
Ferruccio Parri understood from his point of view that it was important to have an institute that was studying this event, this founding event of the Italian democracy, from from an academical, from an historical and social scientific point of view. So different from what a partisan association could do.
Of course, of course.
Then the decades passed, and then more or less 30 years ago, it was understood that we should open our focus not only to the resistance that we still focus or we
Of
still
course.
study, obviously, but most of the events of the 20th century. So
Of course.
the First World War, the fascism, obviously, and then all what happened after the Second World War, because
Of course.
when they founded the Institute, it was recent history. Now we are preparing to celebrate the 80th
Okay.
anniversary of the end of the resistance. So we study everything. For example, the Iveser focused a lot on the history of fascism and anti-fascism in Venice, but even labor history. So trade unions, the workers, the political parties in Italy, in Venice, sorry, after the Second World War, and that is reflecting even in our scientific production.
When was the Venetian part of Iviser open?
We were late starters because
Okay.
those institutes were born a bit more in the 50s or in the 60s. But Venice suffered a bit for the fact that in Padua at the time there was the regional institute. So we were born only in 1992.
Okay, well, but still 30 years, more than 30 years, so.
Yes, but we were amongst the last important institutes to be born
You like the
in.
babies? You have the babies then.
Yes. And you see, and then it was important because at the end that institute, the one in Padova, doesn't exist anymore because it became part of the university. Yeah, long story. Now it is part of the University of
Padova.
Padova. That is not by itself a tragedy because I don't know if you know it, but the University of Padova has the gold medal for resistance.
No, I didn't know this. Okay.
Yes.
Please, please
There are,
explain. Yeah, go on. Tell
allora,
me about it.
after the Second World War, many cities received some decorations for the activity during the resistance. So, for example, in Veneto, Verona is gold medal for resistance. In Italian, it means medaglia d'oro alla resistenza. In the Italian military, the highest military decoration that you can have for participating to a military event, it is the gold medal to military virtue. After the Second World War, many cities received the gold medal or silver medal or bronze medal. But if I remember well, the only university who has such a recognition, it is the Padova University,
Wow. For the work of the professors and the students.
many students, we have to remember something about the resistance in Italy. The resistance in Italy was practically, it was more or less planned and put forward by persons who were in their 50s or in their 40s, but the biggest numbers were young and very young people.
Well, they were doing the groundwork, the actual log what do you call the practical work, were they?
Yes, but even because many Second World War veterans, so those who fought between the fascist war between 1940 and 1943, many of them had enough of fighting. Don't go too far. My grandfather, my paternal grandfather, was a veteran from the Yugoslavia occupation and war, and he didn't participate to the resistance or the fascists, because they weren't even the fascists. I mean, they were not fighting the
Yeah,
Germans,
of
no.
course.
And then one time I asked him, "But why you didn't join the resistance or the others?" And he told me, "Because for me, 3 years in Yugoslavia were enough."
Yeah, I can
So
imagine.
practically the wait in literally fighting the resistance were on the shoulder of people who were 70 years old, 18 years old,
Yes.
and obviously some others who were a bit older. So, for example, there were veterans who joined both the sides. But it is.
My granddad was a partisan actually in Milano. He was and he was, I think he was only 17, 18 or something like that.
Yes.
He's one of the few who escaped the famous killing in the square, the martyrs.
Yes, absolutely.
He could have been one of those, and he only managed to escape because somebody warned him and he ran away in the fields and they didn't catch him. Otherwise his name will be amongst
Amongst the martyrs of Milano.
So yeah, I can understand. So how hard was it for you guys to actually find documents? Because locks
Well,
were
when
still
we
under secrets and stuff like that for many years,
Allora,
the state secret, right?
well, no, not really, not really.
No?
The problem
Oh,
was
okay.
another. The problem was another because by the time that we started to work with the institute, I mean, the institute was founded in 1992, as I told you, and I started to work with the institute practically 3 years later because I asked the thesis to a professor that was working in Venice, in the University of Ca' Foscari University in Venice, who is called Mario Isnenghi, who is really famous for his work about the First World War and the fascism and the resistance from mostly a literature point of view. And so he told me, look, that the Institute for the Resistance in Venice was just founded and they need help. And practically, a big part of those or the core who are working with the institutes are there till then. The problem was that, as I told you, a lot of work was already being done by some point of view. For example, even now, all the main the original papers of the belonging to the Resistance of Venice are in Padova because that institute was. So we had to more or less get away from the grip of those veteran partisans who more or less wanted to tell us what we had to do. And they were those who helped to found the institute. They liked to have an institute, but on the other side, it was difficult for them to let go a younger generation to start to work around it.
Oh, of course, of
And
course.
I remember the first meetings, the first assemblies were a bit nervous because, for example, they were not under many of them, not all of them, but many of them, they were not understanding why we were studying even on the fascist sources.
Yeah, because that's a point when I assume, correct me if I'm wrong, but of the work that you're doing is also history is written by people. And it's fair to give all sides when you talk about a situation like that. And you can be a bit, as you say, on the side. So I think it's correct,
I think
sometimes to have
that
people that are detached in a way, no?
allora, from my point of view, history is made by sources. And you can influence a lot the final result of your study according to the sources that you are able to find or
Exactly. That's what I meant. So, you need to have all of the sources to give a
you have to
fair.
t yeah, technically more wide is the range of sources that you have, and more three-dimensional is the work that comes out.
Exactly. Yeah, but you said in so much better way than I could. Thank you. That's what I meant.
So at the beginning there was this grip that we had to get freedom, and we were helped a lot by one of the partisans who were more linked to the history of resistance in Venice, Cesco Chinello, who had been a young partisan during the Second World War and then a member of the parliament and senator of the Italian Republic for the Communist Party, who was belonging in our way to do the things. He was himself, and he still is, the main historian of the Porto Marghera industrial area. And with his help, we were able to grow up and starting to do our first researches. The first important project that we completed and that is still interesting now, it was a book with the interviews that we did to the last partisans who were alive at the time. We have
Oh,
to remember
wow.
that now the partisans are really in small numbers,
Well,
but
of course,
we are
at
talking
times
about
come by.
25 years ago, the situation was different.
Yeah. And
So,
it is an incredible record now of this because in 20 years' time, none of them will be alive. And so
more or less, yes.
what's written down, it's the
Allora,
last.
I believe, but that is my personal opinion, Monica. You sure you will find other historians who have other idea. I think that the oral history, it is really important for getting the grip of how was, for
Yes.
understand the motivation of a person, but it is in any way something that is decided, it is filtered by the choices of the person who is talking to you. So
Absolutely.
I call it more a narration of history rather than history itself.
Well,
So
you have the history that is written by the documents, and then you have the history that was done by the people that lived it, I
it is
assume.
a narrate.
There's
Yeah,
two, you know.
it is interesting. It is interesting to understand. It can be useful for understanding some details that otherwise are not covered by the documents. But mostly, it helps to understand the mindset and the
Yes.
personal experiences of those who
Yeah.
fought.
And it helps you also understand why certain choices were made. But it's easy to say, oh, we should have done that. Well, when you are not in the situation where you're not,
Absolutely.
you can't,
Yes.
is you don't know what goes through somebody's mind. So
Even
it's
for a particular reason that is interesting for the friends who are listening to us from abroad. The resistance in Italy was important not only because it is at the foundation of the contemporary democracy in Italy, but it is even the first main event in which the Italian population, or better, the population who was still in the areas not yet liberated by the Allied countries, they did what they did because they made a choice.
Yes.
In the previous events, so the First World War, the period after the unification of Italy, they were all more or less, it is the story of a government, of a
Yeah.
kingdom, who sends soldiers to fight, and
Yes.
they more or less in a democratic way decide what to do.
Yes.
With the resistance and with the Republican fascism, everyone decided what to do. To be completely honest, the majority decided to don't do anything for the reason that I already explained. And then you have a range of people who decided to join or to be close to one of the two factions according to the most different motivation. But one thing should be important, mostly for understand those who fought in the resistance. The people who fought in the resistance for the vast majority were people who were either born during the fascism. Or they were born in the really last year of the liberal regime. For liberal regime, I talk about that regime who fought during the First World War and then finished in 1922 when Mussolini became the prime minister. Okay, so the people either they were born during the fascism, or by the time that they were big enough to understand, they only heard the fascist propaganda. Yet many decided to join the resistance. And that is a bit something of, in contrast, it is a kind of breaking a decision rather to those who
Yes,
decided to stay with the fascism
of course.
because they practically, you have to understand, well, you know, but I tell you in general, you have to understand that the fascism was a dictatorship,
Of
and it
course.
was a mass dictatorship regime focused on consensus. That means that the fascism was entering in many ways in the everyday life of
Oh,
every.
absolutely.
So you had it at school, you had it when you were listening to the radio, when you were reading to the newspaper.
Absolutely.
Even the adults, there was the famous Sabato Fascista or Fascist Saturday, where practically everyone had to go to do gymnastic or training, military training exercise, wearing the black shirt. So
Yes.
the fascism did the impossible for try to sneak under every part of the everyday life of the common Italian, mostly Italian males. So
Well, it's brainwashing, isn't it? It's just what it is. It's a way of brainwashing people
It
because
was a
when
way
you
to,
bombard them always with the same
yeah,
thing, then people stop thinking.
it has the distinction, if you want to use this word, to have been amongst the first regimes, the first dictatorship to use the propaganda in this way. At least in the Western world, because there was the communism in Soviet Union,
Of
but the
course, of
Soviet
course.
Union from a social point of view was pretty different, but it was the first one. And all the dictatorship after starting with the Nazism, that's for talk of the other one, they really copied out of that. So for many of those kids or youngsters or lads to join a movement that was practically offering you just to risk your life and to die in a horrible way, either under torture or, if you were lucky, to be shot. If you were
Yes.
not lucky, under torture or in a German concentration camp. So they decided for the most different reason. There were some veterans who opened their eyes when they were at the front. Or many at the beginning they ran away because they had to be conscripted in the fascist army, but they preferred to join the resistance rather than to join the fascist army. But more in general, people who were not happy anymore with the practical regime who throw Italy first in the middle of the World War, and then
Yes.
was unable
Sustain it.
to put forward all those bombastic announcements that we will stop
Of
our
course.
enemies on the beach, and they will swim in their own blood and whatever. So there was a lot of a kind of disillusion who brought even to this event that is quite unique for those countries who started to fight on the Axis side.
Hey, Giulio, I got to say, because this is so interesting. I don't have enough on this episode of this. I want you to come back because I want to talk to you about this in
Okay.
more detail and particularly about what Venice, how Venice went through, Venice and the territory of Venice, the province and stuff. Want to go back to Ivi Cervè. How many people are part of the Institute? How many members do you have at the moment?
Allora, well, this
Active and non-active, let's say.
allora there is we have a staff of people who are working on the everyday work of the institute, and I can assure you we are not a lot. I think that if you count the people who are doing research, those who are taking care of the didactic things like that, I think that we are no more than 8 to 10 persons.
Oh, okay. I thought you were more than that. Okay.
So if you, then there are others who do their job on like a kind of voluntary help, but practically the institute doesn't have a person who are working for it as even as how to say as a boss as somebody who is giving work.
Of
We
course.
have a single teacher who is who was sent by the Ministry of Education, the Ministry of Public Instruction, to take care of the coordination for the didactic activities. And
Okay.
then there is the director, another group, small group of persons who are taking care of a bit of everything. For example, I take care of a bit of the didactic area, mostly for what has to do with the itineraries, so the guided tours to the resistance and the First World War in
Okay.
Venice. And I take care of the library. So everybody is a bit of a jolly because we are a small we are doing quite something
Well, I got to say, thanks to Marco Borghi, you have got amongst the best social medias in the city of Venice. I can
yes,
assure you.
that is I had many persons who are really amazed by the quality of the social media
As a
work.
social media manager, I
It
can
is
tell you, Marco is good.
really yes, he's doing an amazing job. I remember when I was working with the German pavilion of the Biennale 2 years ago, and because we did a project together, I was part of their project for the Biennale of 2022 and 23,
Okay.
and
Oh, with Luisella Romeo as well.
yes,
Ah, okay. But I'm gonna keep you in a few days above the ghetto.
Luisella, yeah, Luis. It was a kind of virtuous circle by in which the German artist who was in charge for the pavilion, who had to bring forward the artistic work for in 2022, Maria Eichhorn, who is a very famous conceptual artist, knew something about the resistance because she had a couple of tours with Luisella Romeo. So Luisella Romeo talked her about the institute. And she came to visit us, and I told her about this project that I started many years ago about those guided tours. Though we call it Italian itinerari resistenti, so resistant itineraries. And then this project was started, and it was a success. And then there was so much work to do that we asked Luisella to join us for be part of the project.
Cool.
So
So
it
let's
was.
talk about Vista Itineraries then, because this is interesting. So you run them as activities for the institute, right?
I started to work on them immediately after the graduation. I am graduated in Ca' Foscari University with a master's degree that I got with a thesis who was talking about the resistance and mostly Venice during the 1943-45 period.
Oh my God, I need to take one of these tours because I never done. And it always fascinated me, this part of the history of Venice. So
So practically.
do you run them like all the time, or are they only on certain periods?
Allora, normal, we had them practically for 2 years for the time in which the Biennale was open, and then in that period we had two tours every week
Oh, okay.
because they were hosted by the Biennale. We do it every day, we do it every year with the Institute, but most of the time they are devoted to didactical activities, so mostly with the schools. But we are always open. We have people, adults who are interested too, and so we are open. We have a really interesting number of those itineraries because I wrote the one related with the resistance because I was fresh of my studies about the
Of course.
resistance, and I tried to build them in a way that it was possible to. It was possible to cover most of the territory in Venice, but we have, for example, one others who are focused on the other part of other pieces of the history of Venice. So the First World War, the Risorgimento. Risorgimento for France for abroad. It is that movement, that series of movement who brought the many Italian states to get unified in a single state in the second half of the 19th century.
That's another episode I'm gonna have to do. Oh my God, you're giving me so many ideas at the moment.
Yeah, well, there I don't know. Yeah, I think I could be able to explain you something, even if I'm specializing in resistance, but we can talk about that later. Anyway, then
Listen,
we have about history of politics in Venice,
and you do
history.
also the heritage walks, don't you?
Yes, so yeah, we put it is a kind of tool that we put at disposition of the civil society when it is possible. Because what is one of the main core of Ivezer? It is to demonstrate that the history of Venice doesn't finish with the end of the Republican Venice in 1797. Napoleon didn't stop the history of Venice. Venice continued to exist for other 2 centuries, being protagonist of the Italian society and the events, historical events of that period, from a military point of view, economical, social, and political. So, without talking about the 19th century, because we could talk a lot about that, but only if you talk about the 20th century, we have a city who was practically the first big city behind the front lines during the First World War. A city where the start of fascism was particularly interesting by this point of view, and then a city who was heralded by the fascism as one of the virtuous examples, because Venice during the in the medieval and modern era was really a sea power over the Mediterranean, and then we have the resistance and a really interesting political story after the Second World War, because but it is just important to talk about what happened to Porto Marghera, to the
Yes, of
darkness of
course.
Porto Marghera.
Of
So
course.
we Itinerivers, I want to say, yes, obviously Venice, it is Venice. You see Venice as it is now because there was this republic who existed for almost a millennium. But even after that, in periods who are much closer to us and much linked to us to the historical level, Venice was a protagonist
I
before
know.
to lose a lot of its assets in the last 30 years.
I know. Is I mean, for me, one of the best ever walks I ever done is a heritage walks in the Giudecca. I discover so many things
Yeah.
about an island that everybody just looks at it. Oh yeah, it's quiet, it's residential, and then you go and you discover above all also in between the 19th and 20th century, the history behind is really, 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 really
Yes,
interesting.
absolutely.
Listen, how did the institute end up in Villa Eriot?
Allora, when the institute was born, practically the institute was a kind of a cupboard inside the schools. Then from the cupboard, we moved to two small offices.
Sorry, I just realized a cupboard.
Yeah, a cupboard. Practically, it was a piece of furniture with our papers inside. That
Oh
was
my
it.
God, cool.
Because remember, Venice is the Republic of Venice that was ended by Napoleon. Nobody was really believing in Venice from a contemporary point of view. Then, for a short time, for another more or less 10-year period, we were in two small rooms in Foscarini High School, and then the principal evicted us.
Ha,
And
nice.
well, long story. And we finished in this at the beginning on two small rooms who were at the top floor of this Villa Heriot, who is part of a complex of two villas built in the late 20s of the last century by a family of wealthy French entrepreneurs. Practically, they were owning one of the first marts in commercial centers in Paris, and they were built in a really particular way, in a kind of a late God, fake
I
Gothic
know,
style.
they're beautiful. I had the
Yes,
opportunity to
and
visit both of them.
yes,
Amazing.
they were projected and built by architect by Giuseppe Mainella, who was a decorator and even in some way architect. And at the end, we had a city council administration who was friendly to us, and we were able first to set foot there, and then when there was a kind of pedagogical library there, then this pedagogical library was moved to a bigger place together with other libraries. So the villa at some point was free, and the situation, we were in the right spot in the wrong in the right spot in the right moment, and so
Thank
we
God.
at some point we were able to get the whole villa. And by the time that I remember, when we took the whole our documentation, everything from a side to the other, just for give you an idea, it was enough. A big boat was enough to bring everything at the time. And then by the time that we got this villa, our possibilities grow up to a really big extent, because then we were able to have a real library, a real place where to put our archives and to put in order our archives. So at the time, there was the second Cacciari administration, who was a center-left administration, but mostly we had an ally in what is called municipality, who is a kind of a local sub-council. At the time, it was we had this we had this friendly administration that allowed us to set foot there, and after that, it was we talked through our work, because obviously we are working with the city council and with the state institutions who are born in who are belonging to the Italian Republic, that is an anti-fascist republic. Even now, even in this period,
Even now,
even in this period, we are part. As long as the constitution, it is the one that is now.
Yes.
It is an anti-fascist constitution.
Of course.
Practically, we worked for what has to do with the schools mostly, and then we had those 2 days who were dedicated to a particular memory. So the 27th of January, that is the memory day to an European level, because on that day, the 27th of January of 1945, the first Soviet troops liberated the extermination camp of Auschwitz. And then in February, we have the day of remembering, Giorno del Ricordo,
Remembrance Day, yeah.
who is dedicated to another really delicate story belonging to the what we call the Eastern Front question. So il confine orientale. So meaning that after the Second World War, Italy lost the war, because even if the resistance won the war, assisting the liberation of the country in any
But
way.
officially, we were the enemies, so yeah, we
Italy
were in the
started
wrong side.
Italy, fascist Italy started the war of aggression against other countries. One of the countries that we aggressed was Yugoslavia. And then Yugoslavia practically got the possession of some areas who are in the on the eastern side of the Adriatic, so the peninsula of Istria and more other places. And then you had many Italians who were lived there, and hundreds of thousands has to flee because the new socialist regime of Tito was not friendly with the Italians, and some thousands of them were killed. There is a word that when we hear this word in Italy, it is always bringing to really heavy feelings. Foibe, foibe is a kind of pit in a karstic area, and that area of Italy, or on the border between Italy and Slovenia and Croatia, there are a lot of those pits. In some of those pits, many, many Italians, some thousands of Italians, were thrown because they were accused to be fascists.
Giulio, you know something interesting? I'm just tiny little bit older than you, not much, but tiny little bit older than you. And I love history, and I remember everything I studied at school. Well, we didn't touch at all this. This was never even mentioned when I went to, and I'm not talking about primary, secondary, I'm talking about high school. Never, you know.
I was born in 1974,
Yeah, I
so
told you you're a bit younger than me.
I did the schools. I did my, let's say, the compulsory schools between the 80s and the early 90s, and I can tell that we hardly talk about the resistance itself.
Exactly. But resistance I did, but the fiber, I specifically remember
I
to hear the
prefer to
first
talk about
time.
Eastern border because it is a more complex. Because it is like when you see about a quarrel of two persons, and you start from the moment in which one of the person kicks the other.
So
It is the thing happened because that area was really heated, and the fascists was present there. That area was gained after the First World War, and as you know, the fascism. Became a regime in Italy a few years after the end of the First World War, and they put together a policy of aggression and denying the ethnic roots of the people who were speaking Slavic, and so people were forced to change their name during the fascism. And the cultural institutions who were advocating the original languages were burned to the ground. People were killed, and that during the Red regime. During the Second World War, Italy put forward a really harsh the fascist Italy put forward a really harsh policy of war against the civilians and partisans in those areas. So. And that doesn't justify what happened later, but what I'm telling you, it is a bigger context that should be studied scientifically, and here we return to what we were talking in the beginning, scientifically, and in general as a context about two different populations in the same area, in a period of the 20th century in which things were happening really fast. And probably another thing that you didn't study at school is that at the end of the Second War, we are used to think about the end of the Second World War as at the end of the most bloody war of the
That's true.
humankind.
And it is
But
not.
we should know that at least that the 1945, it is even the date in which the biggest mass emigration of in Europe of all the time started, because you had the millions of persons who were moving from a side to the others. So there were the Jews who could not return to their houses in Eastern Europe because they were not wanted there.
Of course.
The ethnic Germans who were in part of Germany, or in, you had a lot of ethnic Germans in other states in Eastern Europe who had to flee. They tried to get to Germany. And then in all this, then you had the Pole who were, on some way, they were gaining a part of Germany. On the other side, they were losing a part of Poland because that was. And then in all this situation, there was even those two relatively, if you talk about a square kilometers area, in that small area you had practically hundreds of thousands of Italians that suddenly they had to flee. The most interesting example is the city of Pola, that now is called Pula, who was mainly an Italian city because at the time it was working this way. The Italians were living in the cities on the coastline, and the Slovenians or the Croatians were living in mostly in the villages or in the mainland side. The city of Pula was, it was decided that it would become part of Yugoslavia in 1947, if I remember well. And they had practically it got it was evicted. The Italians were evicted in really few months. And Venice was interesting by this point of view because most of those Italians were coming here as first place.
Yes.
So it is a really
He had a big,
heartbreaking history.
and he had a big part in the city of Venice as well, because I realized that sometimes I'm talking to, people that I 100% sure is Venetian, and we go, oh no, we come from, from Slovenia. I go like, oh really? Okay. And then, they start telling me that my parents had to escape, so I came here when I was a little baby,
Yes,
and
you know,
this is interesting.
there are all a series of cities starting from Trieste, going down to the Istria and then up to the Dalmatian coast, where a lot of before the birth of nationalism, you had really a population of every religion or every origin living more or less together. Then the 20th century, it is sadly even the century of nationalism. And that made the situation not possible anymore. And so you will have a lot of people who were coming from Pirano, so from Pola, from what is called now Rijeka, that in Italian is Fiume, or Zara, Zadar. And some of them, it is a fact that many of those people had to flee. Well, most of them had to go. Really, the big majority. Many of them stayed in Italy. Many others went in other parts of the world. But those who stayed in Italy, they were seen as enemies. That for two reasons mostly. The first is that at the end, we were a period in which we had a war going on. It was the Cold War. So those people were etiquetted, they were tagged almost immediately as fascists, that it was not true. I mean, not always, not in all the cases. And second, Italy was a country who was recovering to a really terrible war, and there was a lot of poverty. And sadly, we know that in a situation of crisis, you have a war where a war from a poor against somebody who is even more poor.
And somebody that is always ready to take advantage
So
of her.
the state lately come to help some of them, so trying to put them in some special list, mostly for fine job and things like that. But it is true that for many time, the Communist Party at the beginning was talking about them in a particular way, and was more or less labeling as fascist, mostly in the 50s, in the early 50s. Then it stopped, and then the Italian government, that was democristian, so Christian Democrat, simply didn't talk about that. That is, in Italian, we are used to say is veramente democristiano. It is
Just
really,
ignore them, and just ignore it.
no, they, yeah, because at the end, at some
They
point,
pretended the problem didn't exist. You just don't talk about it, it doesn't exist,
no,
does it?
they tried even to solve it under the carpet slowly, but but what I can tell without getting into a political level is that now, in this moment, this tragedy, who is touching hundreds of thousands of refugees, plus the people who are living now, so those who were born after that, it is seen mostly as a political agenda question. Sorry, political agenda situation. It is rarely used to talk about the history of those people, but it is used because
True.
some particular parties use it in a political way. And I will not tell more about that, but I hope that who is listening can understand.
Giulio, I mean, you got so much to tell. I mean, I wanted to talk about something else, like the Stolpersteine, but we're running out of time. So I'll tell you what, I want you back. Because I want to talk about Venice and what Venice was during the just
Of course, sorry,
before
yeah,
and during
I
after the
tend a
Second
bit
World
to,
War.
yeah.
All I got to do is switch you on. I can see, I love it.
I'm a huge history lover. So when people start telling me all of these things, for me it's like, oh God, like I'm drooling literally.
Well,
Listen.
if you and your listener are not getting bored, I will be happy to
No, no, no.
listen with
It's
you again.
only I always try to keep it, but not too much, because otherwise, people usually are jogging while they're listening, just in
Yeah,
case
I
they
know. I'm a
drop.
podcast listener myself, so I know, I know, I know, I know.
Right, listen, before we stop, let's remind everybody where they can find on the internet or on social media, Iviser.
Allora, even said we have a rather good
It
website.
is, I got to say, and it's in English too. Well done.
Allora, yes, the weakness until 2 years ago was that it was rather in Italian, because normally we were lucky if somebody in Italy was getting interested to that. Then, with this project of the Biennale, and with all the tours that me and Luisella did in those 2 years, we got many persons interested in it. So,
Good.
even according to a really generous donation that was made to us in that condition, in that situation, we started to translate
Good.
so slowly we are translating the institute, the website
In English.
in English. So www.ibeser.it, so India Victor Echo Sierra Echo Romeo dot India Tango, and that has a lot that for yeah. We have that project that we talked about, the interviews to the partisans are all put into text,
Yes.
and they can be downloaded entirely from the website. And if somebody is coming from abroad, I mean, it can be translated. You can copy and paste, and they can be translated. It worked enough. Then we have a virtual map with all our tours and all the areas who are linked to the period that we're talking about. And then about the social media, yes, we have we as you were telling before, our social
Everywhere.
media curator, it is really doing a great job, and he's active on Instagram,
On Twitter and on Facebook,
on
you're
Twitter, because his name is
everywhere.
Twitter and it will also be Twitter to me. And for those who are a bit older like me, Facebook.
Yes, and it is at Iviser. Simple as
You
that.
search
Yeah, he's. I think he's
and you
at
find it.
Iviser everywhere.
Yes, yes,
Well,
yes.
listen, I definitely want you back, because I definitely I know the people will be interested, because a lot of listen, as you say, everything that goes out about Venice is always the same. I don't want to say, but it's always the same stuff, more or less. And the idea of this podcast is to show all of the other aspects of Venice, all of the other parts. This includes also other parts of the history. So, as you were saying, that it doesn't stop with 1797, but like, for example, I really love to talk to you about it, if you know any, well, I'm pretty sure you do know, about how the islands of Venice were used after Napoleon went, because I
Yeah,
just
well,
wrote
it is a
I
really
just my
interesting
book is
talk.
coming out pretty soon, so I love to have this discussion with somebody that knows more than me, for sure. Because I discovered, like, some of them were used by the Nazis as bases and stuff like that, so it's quite interesting.
And we are still discovering new stuff, eh? Because
I
I mean,
know, I know.
luckily we are still learning, and sometimes we are still getting new sources. So luckily we are still in the position, we are still in the position to learn something of new.
That's beautiful. I love it. Okay, thank you again for talking to us, and I can't wait to have you back. Ciao, ciao.
Bye.
Thank you again, Giulio, for the lovely chat. You can find Giulio at www.iviser.it and on all social media as at Iviser. Thank you again for listening. Venice Talks podcast is a production of Sentire Media, created, produced, and hosted by me, Monica Cesarato. Follow Venice Talks wherever you get your podcast, and if you want to book a food tour or a cooking experience with me, you can find me over at www.monicacesarato.com and on all social medias with the handle at Monica Cesarato, where you can follow my adventures around Venice. And don't forget, if you love this episode, please rate it and leave a review. It's very much appreciated.
Sentire Media.
Hey, podcast producers and show hosts. Do you want to join a podcast network that celebrates all things Italian? At Sentire Media, we understand the allure of Italy and its unique culture. Our devoted team of hosts and producers are all driven by their shared passion for Italy. And we work tirelessly to create the best lifestyle podcasts and content that will whisk you away to the very heart of Italy. With us, you can savor the mouth-watering flavors, get lost in the stories from the past, break down the cultural barriers, and truly immerse yourself in the vibrant traditions of this intoxicating country. If you have a great podcast idea or are already in production and would like to join Sentire Media, head over to sentiremedia.com, that's S-E-N-T-I-R-E media.com, and find out how to submit your show.